This deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. So definitely check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it. Yeah.
Okay, so usually when we talk about a legal contract, there's this inherent expectation of like precision.
Right. Like it's binary.
Exactly. Think about it like engineering. You sign a lease for an apartment, the terms are right there in black and white, and the landlord just points to the paper and says, there it is. You pay exactly this amount on the first of the month. You live here. You don't paint the walls neon green.
Yeah, it's totally transactional. The lines are clearly drawn.
You pay the money, you get the thing. It's incredibly clean.
And it's comforting. I mean, as humans, we like things to be visible. We want them categorized into neat little boxes so we know exactly what we're buying.
But then you step into this highly specific, highly lucrative world where Wall Street just collides head on with the insurance industry. And suddenly that neat little categorization machine is completely broken.
Smashed to pieces, honestly.
We are looking at a product landscape today in this deep dive that is, well, honestly, it's murky. It's the absolute definition of muddy waters.
Oh, completely. It's the great blur.
Right. You look at a contract and you have to ask yourself, wait, am I buying a traditional safe insurance policy right now? Or did I just buy a highly volatile, high-risk equity investment?
It's a massive gray area.
Yeah.
And it is exactly where the writers of the Series 66 exam love to live. I mean, they basically build their summer homes in this gray area.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Because today, your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to completely crush the insurance-based products unit on your Series 66 exam.
And this material makes up a huge chunk of your test.
Yeah, we're talking about a portion of 17 testable questions that hover right in this blurry territory.
And let's put that in perspective for you. 17 questions is literally the difference between passing and having to take the exam all over again in 30 days.
It's a massive swing factor.
It really is. If you can lock down the logic of this specific unit, you are essentially building a fortress around your passing score.
Huge. But here is our agreement with you today. We know how your brain works, especially if you're dealing with ADHD.
Right, the standard study methods just don't cut it.
Exactly. We know that if we sit here and read you a dry, dusty textbook definition of an annuity, like if we just rattle off the statutory definition of an insurance wrapper, your eyes are going to glaze
Oh,
over.
you'll be gone. You'll start thinking about what to have for lunch.
Or what you're doing this weekend, you'll lose the thread completely. So no dry textbook reading today.
None. We are banning the textbook terminology where it isn't strictly necessary for the
Just
test.
tossing it right out the window. Instead, we're going to use ridiculous scenarios. We are bringing in a cast of highly alliterative, entirely fictional characters to act out these financial products.
And we are going to throw direct pop quizzes at you, right in your ears.
Yes. To force your brain to actually lock this information in, because you don't just need to recognize these terms on a flashcard, right? You need to be able to recall them.
You need to be able to play with them and apply them under the stress of the actual exam clock counting down.
Which is exactly why we need to start with the master key.
Right. If you're going to navigate these murky waters between what is insurance and what is a security, you need a compass.
And in this unit, that compass is one single overriding question. It's the ultimate golden rule.
If you understand this rule, the rest is just filling in the blanks.
So lay it on us. What is the rule? Because I feel like people get incredibly tangled up in the jargon.
The rule is this: who bears the investment risk?
Who bears the investment risk? Okay, I love this, but it almost sounds too simple. Like, explain what you mean by that.
I mean, it unlocks 90% of this unit. Every single time you look at a question about an annuity or a life insurance policy, I want you to mentally stop.
Just pause and ignore the noise.
Exactly. Ignore all the fancy jargon and ask yourself one practical question. If the stock market crashes tomorrow, like if the S&P 500 drops 30% in a week, who is actually losing money?
Who is taking the financial hit?
Right. Who takes the punch to the jaw?
So, if the insurance company bears the risk, meaning they promised you a certain amount of money, and even if the market goes to absolute zero, they still have to write you that exact same check out of their own pocket.
Then it's just insurance. It's a standard insurance product.
Because they're absorbing the risk of the unknown.
Exactly. Which is the fundamental definition of insurance.
But, and here's the flip side. If you, the buyer, the person holding the contract, bear the risk.
Right. Meaning, if the market tanks, your account value tanks right along with it.
And the insurance company just shrugs and says, you know, sorry about your luck. Then boom, it's a security.
You got it. That shift in risk changes everything about the product. It changes how the product is legally regulated.
It changes how the IRS taxes it.
And it changes who is legally allowed to sit across the desk and sell it to you. Who bears the investment risk? I mean, write it on your hand.
Put it on a sticky note on your monitor. I am officially tattooing it on my brain.
It's that important.
All right, so let's take this golden rule, this compass, and walk right into our first major arena, the annuity arena.
Let's do it.
Let's start with the absolute basics before things get weird and complicated. What actually is an annuity? Because people hear that word and they immediately tune out.
Right. Well, at its most basic historical level, an annuity is simply a contract between an individual and an insurance company.
Okay. Just a contract.
Yeah. The core design, the entire fundamental purpose of this product since it was invented, is to provide income, either immediately, like right now, or at some point in the future.
So you give the insurance company a pile of money and they promise to pay you an income stream.
Essentially, yes. It's a way to buy yourself a personal pension so you don't outlive your money.
Okay, buying a personal pension, I give you a lump sum, you give me a paycheck. Makes sense.
Exactly.
So to help us visualize this, I want to introduce our first recurring character. I want you, the listener, to picture a guy named Cautious Carl.
Oh, I love Cautious Carl.
Cautious Carl is terrified of the stock market. He looks at a stock chart on the news and literally breaks out in hives.
He keeps his life savings stuffed inside a fireproof mattress.
He wears a bicycle helmet just to walk down his driveway to check the mailbox. He looks both ways before crossing a one-way street.
Carl wants absolute safety. He wants a rock-solid guarantee.
So Carl walks into an insurance agent's office and he buys what is called a fixed annuity. What exactly is the insurance company giving Carl here?
They're giving him exactly what his nervous system craves, a guarantee.
Right.
In a fixed annuity, the insurance company promises Cautious Carl a guaranteed fixed rate of return for a specified period.
So they might look at Carl, take his mattress money, and say, Carl, we will guarantee you a 4% return every single year, no matter what happens in the outside world.
Exactly. 4% guaranteed.
So let's run the extremes. The stock market could go up 20% in a massive bull run. The market could drop 50% in a massive recession.
Aliens could land on the White House lawn. Interest rates could go negative.
And Carl is still sitting there in his helmet getting his 4%.
Correct. It provides predictable, incredibly stable income. Now, the mechanics of how they do this is really important for the exam.
Walk us through it.
The insurance company takes Carl's money and they put it into their own general account. This is the massive pool of money the insurance company manages.
Okay, the general account.
Right. And they usually invest that general account in very safe, boring, long-term bonds.
Wait, hold up. Push back here. Yeah, if I'm an insurance company and I'm guaranteeing a 4% return to Carl,
yeah,
but the bond market crashes and my general account only makes 1% that year, where is that other 3% coming from? Are they just magically printing money?
That is the exact right question to ask. If the general account underperforms, the insurance company has to dig into their own corporate pockets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they use their own capital reserves to make up the difference. State insurance regulators require them to hold massive cash reserves for this exact reason.
So Carl is getting his 4%, even if the insurance company has to take a loss to give it to him.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's apply our golden rule. I'm going to ask you, the listener, right now, think about it.
You ready?
In Cautious Carl's fixed annuity, if the stock market completely crashes, who bears the investment risk? Who loses money? I'll give you a beat. Think about it.
Apply the rule.
It's the insurance company.
Right.
Because they promised Carl 4%. They're legally, contractually obligated to pay him that 4%.
If their own investments tank, Carl doesn't care. Carl is completely insulated.
And because the insurance company bears all of the investment risk, Cautious Carl takes zero investment risk.
Right. And here is where we need to apply this to the exam. This is a huge point.
Let's hear it.
Because Carl takes no investment risk, a fixed annuity is not a security. Let me say that again, because it's foundational. A fixed annuity is not considered a security.
So since it's not a security, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, does not care about it.
Not at all. Huh. It is not regulated by FINRA. It is regulated solely by state insurance departments.
The state insurance commissioner is the one watching over Cautious Carl's contract to make sure the company has the reserves to pay him.
Exactly. State-regulated only.
Okay, so Carl is safe. He's got his 4%. But there is a catch, right? There is always a catch in finance.
Oh, there is absolutely a catch.
Let's say it's year two of the contract. Carl suddenly decides he needs his money back because he wants to buy a more reinforced, military-grade titanium mailbox helmet. Can he just walk into the office and pull his cash out?
He can, but it's going to hurt him financially. This is where we introduce the concept of surrender charges.
Surrender charges.
Okay. If Carl tries to make an early withdrawal from his annuity, the insurance company is going to hit it with a substantial penalty fee.
I like to think of this as a financial escape room. You are locked in. You can leave the room before the timer is up, but there's a big red button on the door.
And if you press it, it's going to cost you.
A severe penalty. But why do they do this? Why penalize poor cautious Carl just for wanting his own money back?
Think about it strictly from the insurance company's perspective. To guarantee Carl that 4% for the next decade, they had to take his lump sum and lock it up in illiquid long-term investments.
Like those 10-year corporate bonds we talked about.
Exactly. If Carl suddenly shows up in year two and demands a massive cash withdrawal, the insurance company might have to sell those bonds early.
Potentially at a loss.
Right, just to get the liquidity to pay him. So the surrender charge exists entirely to protect the insurance company from that liquidity risk.
Makes total sense. They are penalizing him for breaking the timeline they built their math around.
Yeah.
And these surrender charges aren't permanent, right? They usually decline over time.
Yes, typically over a 5 to 7 year period. Let's do the math on a 7 year surrender schedule. Let's say Carl put in $100,000.
Okay, 100K.
If he panics and withdraws the whole thing in year one, the penalty might be 7%. That's a $7,000 fee just to get his money back.
Ouch.
In year two, the penalty drops to 6%, so 6,000. Year three, 5%. It steps down stair by stair until year eight, when it hits zero.
And after that surrender period is completely over, Carl can access his money without the insurance company penalizing him.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's lock in the recap on cautious Carl's fixed annuity. It provides a guaranteed return. The insurance company bears the investment risk. Because of that, it is not a security. It is state regulated. It has surrender charges if you try to escape early. It is simple, safe, and incredibly boring.
Very boring, which is exactly what Carl wants.
But what happens when someone looks at that 4% guarantee and just yawns?
Well, let's find out.
I want to do a complete pattern interrupt here. Listeners, reset your brains. I want you to imagine the flashing lights, the ringing sirens, the chaotic energy of a Las Vegas casino floor at midnight.
Forget cautious Carl.
Enter Vegas Val.
Vegas Val is the polar opposite of Carl. She doesn't even know what a bicycle helmet is.
Val loves risk. She loves adrenaline. She drives a motorcycle. She day trades crypto on her phone while skydiving. She does not want a boring 4% guarantee.
She looks at 4% and laughs.
Right. She wants massive, aggressive market growth. She wants to ride the huge waves of the stock market. So Vegas Val walks into the office and she does not buy a fixed annuity. She buys what is called a variable annuity.
And this product right here is the most frequently tested insurance product on the Series 66 exam.
The variable annuity.
You need to know this inside and out.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics deeply. Val gives the insurance company her $100,000. But instead of the insurance company putting it in their boring general account and guaranteeing her a flat return, what happens?
The insurance company essentially hands Val a menu.
A menu?
Yeah. Val gets to choose where her money goes. The money goes into a separate account, and within that separate account, she chooses from a list of what are called sub-accounts.
Sub-accounts. I love this term because it sounds so highly technical and secretive, but I want you, the listener, to think of sub-accounts simply as mutual funds in a witness protection program.
That is actually a brilliant way to conceptualize it.
Right. If you look at them, they look exactly like mutual funds. They act exactly like mutual funds.
They have aggressive equity portfolios, conservative bond portfolios, money market portfolios. They have portfolio managers.
But because they are hiding inside the legal wrapper of an insurance annuity, they aren't legally allowed to call themselves mutual funds. They have to wear a fake mustache and go by the name subaccounts.
Exactly. And to prove your point, they are actually registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, just like standard open-end mutual funds.
Wow. Okay. So Vegas Val looks at this menu of subaccounts and she says, put all my $100,000 in the aggressive growth tech stock subaccount. Let it ride.
Yep. She goes all in.
Okay. Time for a direct question to you, the listener. Get ready to apply the golden rule. Vegas Val puts her $100,000 into the aggressive equity subaccount. The very next week, the tech market completely crashes.
A massive bubble bursts.
Those stocks lose half their value. The account drops to $50,000. Who loses money? I'll give you a beat. Think about the contract.
Who takes the hit?
It's Val. Val loses the money.
Right. Because Val chose the investments, the return depends entirely on the performance of the underlying subaccounts she picked.
There is no 4% guarantee.
There was no general account bailing her out.
Huh.
If the account drops to $50,000, Val's statement says $50,000. Therefore, the contract owner, Vegas Val, bears the investment risk.
And what does our golden rule tell us? If the contract owner bears the investment risk, boom, this is a security.
It absolutely is a security.
And that single legal classification triggers an absolute avalanche of regulatory requirements, doesn't it?
Oh, completely. Because it is a security, it cannot hide in the shadows of state insurance law. It must be registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC.
It must be sold with a prospectus.
Right. You cannot legally sell a variable annuity to Val without handing her a prospectus that outlines all the risks, the historical performance, and the massive fees of those subaccounts.
And what about the person sitting across the desk selling it to Val? Let's say I'm an insurance agent. I sold Cautious Carl his fixed annuity. Can I just turn around and sell this variable annuity to Val?
No, not unless you've been studying.
Why not?
Because a variable annuity is both an insurance product, it's an annuity wrapper, A and D is security, due to the subaccounts bearing investment risk.
So what does the agent need?
The individual selling it must hold both a securities license, like your Series 66 and Series 7, and a state insurance license. Dual licensing is strictly required.
Dual licensing. Okay, so Vegas Val is taking all this investment risk, but she is still buying this inside an annuity wrapper, which means the insurance company is involved in the background. And insurance companies do not work for free.
Never.
Let's talk about the fees, because there is a very specific, unique fee here that the exam loves to test. It's called the M&E charge.
The mortality and expense risk charge.
Yeah.
M&E for short.
Vegas Val looks at her annual statement and sees this M&E charge taking, let's say, 1.25 to 1.5% out of her total account value every single year. She is furious. She calls her broker and demands to know why she is paying this.
And honestly, you can understand why she's mad.
I'm with Val here. If she's taking all the investment risk, why is the insurance company taking a 1.5% cut off the top just for the privilege of holding her money?
She is paying it because of the fundamental nature of what an annuity actually is, which we established at the beginning. Remember, an annuity is a promise to provide income, potentially, for the rest of Val's life. Now, Val is taking the investment risk right now while the account is growing. But what if, 20 years from now, Val decides to turn this pot of money into a lifetime payout?
Right.
What if she starts taking monthly checks and she lives to be 110 years old? Let's say her subaccounts perform terribly, the market crashes, her account balance hits absolute zero when she's 95. But the insurance company still promised to pay her $2,000 a month until she dies.
Oh, wow. Wait. So if the account hits zero, but she has a lifetime payout guarantee, the insurance company has to keep paying her that $2,000 a month out of their own pocket for the next 15 years.
Exactly. That is a massive, terrifying risk for the insurance company. They are taking on the risk that Val will live too long.
That is the mortality risk.
Right. And they are taking on the risk that their administrative costs to manage this complex contract will go up over the next 40 years. That is the expense risk.
Mortality and expense.
Right. To cover that massive future liability, they charge the M&E fee every single year to build up a reserve pool.
So it's basically the insurance company charging Val an ongoing insurance premium to cover their own tails in case she discovers the fountain of youth and becomes immortal.
That's one highly accurate way to look at it.
Yeah.
And here is the major exam trap alert for the listener.
Pay attention here.
The M&E charge is completely unique to variable annuities. Cautious Carl does not pay an M&E charge on his fixed annuity.
I don't get that. Why wouldn't they charge Carl? They promised him income too, right?
Yes, but in a fixed annuity, the insurance company isn't guaranteeing a lifetime payment based on wildly fluctuating subaccount values. They already factored all their risk, mortality, and otherwise into that flat 4% they offered him up front.
They did the math before they made the offer.
Exactly. In a variable annuity, the account value fluctuates wildly based on the stock market, making the future lifetime guarantee much, much harder to predict for the insurer. Hence, the M&E charge is only found on the variable side to compensate for that unknown variable.
That is a crucial distinction. M&E equals variable annuity only. Lock that away. Okay, so Vegas Val is paying her M&E fees. Her sub-accounts are hopefully growing. This brings us to the next phase of her journey. The tax man.
Let's talk taxes.
The tax treatment of these variable annuities is heavily, heavily tested.
Right. To understand the taxes, you have to understand what phase of the annuity lifecycle Val is currently in. Right now, Val is in what we call the accumulation phase.
She is accumulating. She's putting money in, making purchase payments. She's letting it ride.
Right. And the massive benefit of the annuity wrapper, the reason anyone buys these things, despite the high fees, is tax-deferred growth during this accumulation phase.
Tax-deferred growth. Okay.
All the dividends paid by those subaccounts, all the capital gains when the portfolio manager buys and sells stocks inside the subaccount. Val doesn't pay a single dime of taxes on them year over year.
She doesn't get a 1099 form in the mail every spring.
Nope. The money just grows and compounds, completely shielded from taxes.
Which sounds absolutely amazing. It's like a superpower for compounding interest. But the IRS is incredibly patient, and they always get their cut eventually. Let's walk through a scenario with real math.
Let's do it.
Let's say Val is 50 years old. She put in $100,000 of her own after-tax money over the last decade. That is her principal, her cost basis. Now, thanks to some really lucky tech stock picks and her sub-accounts, the account has grown. The total value is now $150,000.
Okay, so she has her $100,000 principal and $50,000 in pure earnings.
Right. Total value, $150,000.
I'm tracking.
Now, Val, being Val, decides she wants to buy a high-end turbocharged jet ski. She needs exactly $30,000 cash. She calls up the insurance company and says, send me a check for $30,000 from my variable annuity.
Okay.
Here's my direct question to you, the listener. Think carefully before I answer.
Oh.
How is Val taxed when she pulls that $30,000 out? I want you to really think about the breakdown of her money principal versus earnings. I'll give you a second.
This is a classic exam question.
The answer comes down to four very painful letters, LIFO.
OVFO. Last in, first out.
Break this down for us, because this feels like the IRS actively hating the taxpayer. Why is LIFO so punishing here?
It is punishing by design. The IRS rules state that for annuities, the last money that went into the account is assumed to be the growth, the earnings.
Okay.
And the rule of LIFO states that when you withdraw money during the accumulation phase, the earnings are forced to come out first.
So if Val wants $30,000, she might be thinking, hey, I'll just withdraw $30,000 of the original $100,000 I put in, which is my own money, so it shouldn't be taxed.
But the IRS says, nope, you have $50,000 in earnings sitting there. That entire $30,000 withdrawal is coming directly out of your earnings pool.
And because every penny of that $30,000 is classified as earnings, it is 100% fully taxable. But here's the real kicker. How is it taxed? So since it grew in subaccounts that act like mutual funds buying and selling stocks, it gets the long-term capital gains tax rate right, which is much lower.
Oh, you just fell right into the Series 66 bear trap.
That
is exactly what people assume. And it is completely wrong. Mm. It is not taxed as capital gains. The IRS treats annuity earnings as ordinary income.
Ouch. So she loses the capital gains benefit entirely.
Entirely. Let's say Val is a high earner in the 32% tax bracket.
Mm.
That $30,000 withdrawal is going to be hit with a 32% tax rate right off the bat. That's $9,600 going straight to the federal government.
That is brutal.
Oh, but it gets worse for Val. Because remember how old Val is in your scenario?
She is 50 years old.
Yes. I see what you're doing.
Mm.
Listeners, pay attention. Because Val is under the age of 59 and a half, the IRS is not just going to charge her that $9,600 in ordinary income tax.
No. They are going to slap her with the dreaded 10% IRS early withdrawal penalty.
Yeah, double hit.
This is the math you need to know. She pays income tax, PLUS, a 10% penalty on the $30,000. So that's another $3,000 penalty. Add that to the $9,600 in income tax. She is paying $12,600 in taxes just to get $30,000 out.
She only takes home $17,400. That's barely half.
Why is the IRS so aggressive here?
It's behavioral economics. The government gave Val the incredible gift of tax-deferred compounding for years. The policy reason they gave her that gift was to encourage her to save for retirement.
Ah, so if she breaks the seal early to buy a jet ski.
The government views that as a violation of the deal. They penalize you severely. to disincentivize using an annuity as a short-term piggy bank.
Okay, so Val pays a fortune in taxes and penalties, but she gets her jet ski. Now, I want to explore a much darker scenario to explain another key feature of variable annuities. Let's talk about the death benefit.
Okay, let's go there.
Let's rewind. Val has her $150,000 account. Suddenly, the tech market totally collapses, an absolute bloodbath. Her total account value drops from $150,000 all the way down to $60,000.
So she's actually lost a massive chunk of her original $100,000 investment.
Right. And then the very next day, she tragically dies in a jet ski accident.
A truly tragic end for Vegas Val.
Truly. But we have to look at the contract. What happens to her variable annuity? Does her family just get a check for the measly $60,000 that's left in the account?
This is where the actual insurance component of a variable annuity steps into the light.
Oh.
A variable annuity comes standard with a death benefit guarantee. This guarantee states that if the annuitant dies during the accumulation phase, the beneficiaries will receive the current market value of the account, or are the original amount invested, whichever is greater.
Wait. Let me make sure I have this straight, because this sounds like a massive loophole. Even if she lost almost half her money in the stock market, her heirs still get her original investment back.
Yes. Let's run the exact math on your tragic scenario. Her original investment was 100K. The account's actual market value dropped to 60K. Yep. When she dies, the insurance company looks at the contract.
The greater of the two is 100K.
Right. The insurance company will step in and pay her beneficiaries the guaranteed $100,000. They magically make up the $40,000 difference.
That is wild. I mean, from an investment standpoint, it's incredible. But how can the insurance company afford to just eat a $40,000 loss like that?
Well, think back 10 minutes ago. Remember that M&E fee that Val was so furious about paying?
Yeah.
At 1.5% they siphoned off every year?
Yes.
That is exactly how they pay for it. The M&E fee pools all that money from all their clients to pay for the exact death benefit guarantees when the market crashes and someone happens to die at the bottom of the dip.
Wow. You are paying for that insurance protection.
The
puzzle pieces are fitting together. But hold on, there is an exam trap here. Let's show it, not just tell it. Let's say Val didn't die at 50. Let's say she lived to 65, she retired, and she started taking monthly lifetime payout checks from this annuity.
Okay, she annuitized.
Right. Then the market crashes, her account drops to $60,000, and she dies. Does her family still get the $100,000 original investment back?
They absolutely do not, and this is the critical exam distinction. The magical death benefit guarantee only applies during the accumulation phase.
So it only exists while you are putting money in or letting it grow?
Correct. Once Val makes a decision to turn that pot of money into a stream of regular income payments, a process called annuitization, the accumulation phase officially ends. And the second you annuitize, that original death benefit guarantee vanishes into thin air.
Got it. Accumulation phase only. If you annuitize, the guarantee is gone. Okay, so we've met Cautious Carl, who wants zero risk and 4%. We've met Vegas Val, who wants all the risk and sub-accounts. Now it is time to introduce our third character.
Let's bring her in.
Let's imagine someone who looks at both of them and says, I want the best of both worlds. Enter. Indecisive Irene.
Indecisive Irene. The hardest customer in the financial industry to please.
Irene looks at Carl making 4% and says, that's boring. 4% barely beats inflation. I can't build wealth on 4%.
True.
But then she looks at Val losing half her account in a market crash and says, I am absolutely terrified of losing my hard-earned principal. I would never sleep at night.
Also true.
Irene wants the market gains of Vegas Val, but she wants the total absolute safety of Cautious Carl. She wants her cake, she wants to eat it, and she wants to wear a bicycle helmet while doing it.
It sounds mathematically impossible. But the insurance industry is incredibly creative. They engineered a specific product for indecisive Irene. It is called the Equity Indexed Annuity.
The EIA.
Sometimes you'll see it on the exam as a fixed indexed annuity. They are the exact same thing.
The ultimate compromise product. How does this thing actually work? How do they give her both?
Instead of giving Irene a fixed 4% like Carl, or making her pick highly volatile sub-accounts like Val, the insurance company says, Irene, we are going to link your returns to a major stock market index, usually the S&P 500.
So if the S&P 500 goes up, your account goes up.
Right.
Oh, wow, Irene says. So I get stock market growth. I'm an investor.
Yes. But, the insurance company adds, we are also going to give you a guaranteed minimum return, a floor. Even if the S&P 500 drops 30% in a massive recession, you will never lose a single penny of your principal.
Oh, wow, Irene says. So I get total safety too. I mean, it sounds too good to be true. There has to be a massive catch here.
And there is. The catch comes in the form of trade-offs. To explain those trade-offs, we have to look deeply at the mechanics of how the returns are actually calculated year over year.
To break this down, I'm going to use an absurd analogy. I want you, the listener, to picture Irene at a bowling alley. But this isn't a normal bowling alley. This is bumper bowling at the casino.
Okay, you have my attention. Walk us through bumper bowling at the casino.
There are three mechanical levers in an equity-indexed annuity that act like the rules of this weird bowling alley. Lever number one, the participation rate.
The participation rate.
Let's say Irene's participation rate in her contract is 80%. This means if the S&P 500 index gains a beautiful 10% for the year, Irene does not get the full 10%. She only gets to participate in 80% of that gain.
So we do the math. 80% of 10% means Irene gets an 8% return.
Right. The casino takes a 2% cut of her winnings right off the top, just for letting her play the game with their safety net.
Exactly.
Lever number two, the cap rate. Let's say the bowling alley has a really, really low ceiling. Irene throws a massive strike. The S&P 500 has an incredible bull market year and goes up 20%. But Irene's contract has a cap rate of 7%.
Meaning 7% is the absolute maximum return she can be credited in any single year, regardless of how spectacularly well the index performs.
The ball hits the low ceiling. The market went up 20%, but Irene only gets 7%. The insurance company keeps the massive 13% difference.
That is the heavy trade-off she pays for her safety.
And then there is lever number three, which is the entire reason Irene bought the product, and the most important one for the exam, the floor.
The bumpers.
The bumpers. Let's say Irene throws a terrible gutter ball, the economy goes into a recession, the S&P 500 crashes and loses 15% for the year, but Irene's contract has a 0% floor. The bumpers pop out and keep her ball completely out of the gutter.
So the market lost 15%, but Irene loses nothing.
Her return for the year is exactly 0%. She didn't make a dime of profit, but she didn't lose a single penny of her original principal.
The floor is the guaranteed minimum return, mathematically protecting her against all market losses. And this brings us to the ultimate exam trap for equity-indexed annuities. Let's see if you can spot it.
Okay, let me set it up. I completely disagree with how this is regulated. Irene's annuity return is explicitly mathematically linked to the performance of the S&P 500 stock market index.
Yes, it is.
If the stock market goes up, she makes money.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is intrinsically linked to the stock market, an equity index annuity must be a security, right? I mean, how could it not be?
I understand the logic, but it is completely wrong. And I am aggressively correcting this assumption because it trips up thousands of test takers every year. Equity indexed annuities are not securities.
I don't get that. How can the SEC look at a product that tracks the S&P 500 and say, yeah, that's just insurance. We don't need to regulate that. That feels like a massive regulatory loophole.
You have to go back to our compass. Apply the golden rule. Who bears the investment risk? Look at the bad year.
Yeah.
If the S&P 500 crashes 15%, who actually takes the financial loss?
No.
Does Irene?
No, because of the 0% floor, she loses nothing.
Exactly. The insurance company has to absorb that 15% loss to protect her principal. Because the insurance company bears the downside investment risk, it's legally defined as an insurance product, not a security.
Okay, let me try to summarize that to make sure I get it. Irene doesn't pick any sub-accounts.
Yep.
She isn't actively managing mutual fund-like portfolios where she can lose money. She's just letting the insurance company track an index, and the insurance company is promising to take the hit if things go south.
Exactly. There was a huge battle over this historically, but the SEC eventually issued Rule 151A, which basically solidifies this exemption. As long as the insurance company is guaranteeing that strict floor and taking the risk of market crashes, the EIA stays safely on the insurance side of the regulatory fence.
No prospectus needed, no securities license needed to sell it, just a standard insurance license.
You got it.
So, to lock in Irene's bumper bowling EIA, it's linked to an index, it has a participation rate, which is the casino cut, a cap rate, the low ceiling, and a floor, the bumpers. And most importantly, despite tracking the stock market, it is not a security because the insurer bears the downside risk.
Perfect summary.
Yeah.
Now let's transition the timeline. All of our characters, Carl, Val, and Irene, have been in the accumulation phase for decades.
They've been growing their pots of money through fixed rates, sub-accounts, and index tracking.
But eventually, they get old. They are going to retire. They want to actually use this money. They want to turn that massive pot of accumulated wealth into a steady, reliable paycheck.
We are entering the annuitization phase, the game of life and death.
Yeah, when you annuitize, you are crossing a point of no return. You are making an irrevocable decision.
You are handing your entire accumulated pot of money over to the insurance company, and in exchange, they promise to send you a check on a regular basis.
But you have to choose how they pay you. You have to pick a payout option.
And there are several options on the menu, but before we just list them off like a textbook, what is the core logic here? I need to understand the underlying mechanics of these choices so I don't just have to memorize a list.
The core actuarial logic, the ultimate trade-off you are making with the insurance company, is this. More protection for your beneficiaries means smaller periodic payments for you.
Let me repeat that, because it's the key to every question in this section. Listen up. More protection for your heirs equals a smaller monthly check for you.
Exactly. Let's do a side-by-side comparison of the payout options to see how this dial turns in real life. Option one, life only.
Life only. It is exactly what it sounds like. The insurance company pays you a set amount every single month for as long as you live. When you die, the payments stop immediately.
Right.
I call this the YOLO option. You only live once. Because if you choose life only, let's say you hand the insurance company $500,000, you get your first monthly check for $3,000. Right. And then tragedy strikes. You step off the curb and get hit by a bus on month two. What happens to the remaining $497,000 you just gave the insurance company?
The insurance company keeps it.
All of it.
All of it. It goes into their reserve pool. Your beneficiaries, your kids, your spouse, they get absolutely nothing. Zero.
Brutal. Absolutely brutal.
It is.
But because it's brutal, let's test the logic.
Yeah.
Out of all the payout options on the menu, which one gives you the absolute biggest monthly check while you are alive? Think about the risk the insurance company is taking based on our core logic. I'll give you a beat.
Think about the trade-off.
It's life only.
Yes. Life only provides the highest periodic payment. Why? Because the insurance company is taking on the absolute least long-term risk regarding your heirs.
They are playing the actuarial odds.
Exactly. They employ rooms full of mathematicians who know that statistically, some people will die in month two, allowing the company to keep the massive pot of principal. That kept money offsets the risk of the people who choose life only and live to be 110.
Because you are demanding zero protection for your beneficiaries, your monthly check is maxed out.
Right.
Okay, so what if cautious Carl wants a lifetime payout, but he says, I don't want the insurance company keeping $500,000 if I die next year. That's crazy. I want my kids to get something.
Then Carl would look at the menu and choose option two, life with period certain.
How does the math work on that one?
You get paid for life no matter how long you live. But E.T., you also select a certain period, let's say 10 years. If you die in year three, the insurance company must continue making payments to your beneficiaries for the remaining 7 years of that 10-year period.
So there's a safety net for the heirs. It guarantees at least a decade of payments go out to someone, either Carl or his kids.
Exactly. But apply our core logic. You added a 10-year safety net protection for your beneficiaries. The insurance company is taking on more risk. Therefore, the monthly check Carl receives while he's alive will be mathematically lower than if he had chosen the YOLO life only option.
Makes perfect sense. The dial turns towards safety, the check goes down. Okay. Option three, joint and survivor.
Let's do it.
Let's say Carl is married. He's 65. His wife is 60. He wants a payout that lasts for his entire life and D, his wife's entire life.
With joint and survivor, the payments continue for the lifetime of two separate annuitants. When the first person dies, let's say Carl dies at 80, the payments seamlessly continue to his surviving wife.
Sometimes the contract keeps it at 100% of the original amount. Sometimes it drops to 75% or 50% to the survivor, depending on what they chose up front.
Right.
Okay, let me guess. Since joint and survivor covers two entire human beings instead of one, it must pay out the absolute most money every month, right? I mean, it's double the coverage.
You just stepped right on the landmine.
Did I?
The Series 66 exam writers are high-fiving right now because that is exactly what they hope you assume. You are dead wrong. It pays the least per month.
Wait, why? Explain the actuarial science behind why it pays the least.
Think about the insurance company's total liability. With life only, they just have to worry about one person living a long time.
Okay.
With joint and survivor, you have a 65-year-old and a 60-year-old. The insurance company is on the hook for two entirely separate lifespans. Actuarially speaking, the statistical odds of at least one of those two people living to be 95 or 100 are incredibly high.
Ah, so the insurance company knows they're likely going to be writing checks for 35 or 40 years.
Exactly. Because the insurer is taking on significantly more risk of a long payout period, they drastically slash the size of the monthly check to compensate.
Wow. Okay, that makes perfect sense when you explain the math. Joint and survivor equals the lowest periodic payment. Got it. And the final option on the menu, just to round it out, fixed period.
Very straightforward. You don't tie the payments to a human lifespan at all. You take the mortality risk out of the equation.
You just say to the company, take my pot of money and pay me out over exactly 15 years.
Right. If you live to be 100, they stop paying you after 15 years. If you die in year 5, your heirs get the remaining 10 years of payments. The size of the check just depends on basic division, the length of the period you choose, and the size of your pot.
Okay, that is the entire annuity arena. Let's take a breath.
Good idea.
Shake it out. Roll your shoulders. Because we are about to do a major pattern interrupt. We are closing the book on annuities, and we are stepping into a completely different building. We are pivoting to life insurance.
Different products, entirely different goals. Annuities are about outliving your money. Life insurance is about dying too soon. But hear me clearly. As we navigate these new products, the exact same golden rule applies.
Who bears the investment risk?
Always.
Let's run the gauntlet. We'll start with the non-securities, the pure insurance products. Let's bring cautious Carl back. Carl wants to make sure his family is provided for if he gets hit by a bus on his way to the mailbox. He buys the simplest product on the market, term life insurance.
Term life is pure, unadulterated insurance protection. You buy a policy for a specified term, say 10, 20, or 30 years. You pay a premium every month.
If you die during that 20-year term, your family gets a massive tax-free death benefit.
If you outlive the 20-year term, the policy simply expires. It's over.
I always compare term life to renting an apartment.
Yeah.
You pay your rent every month for a year. In exchange, you get a roof over your head.
Right.
But at the end of the year, your lease is up. Do you have any equity in the building? No. Do you get any of your rent money back? No. You walk away with absolutely nothing.
It's a perfect analogy. Because term life builds absolutely zero cash value. There is no savings account attached to it. There is no investment component whatsoever.
It is the least expensive type of life insurance.
Yeah.
Because you are literally only paying for the pure statistical cost of the death benefit risk.
I'd like to.
And because there is no investment component, there is obviously no investment risk. So let's apply the rule.
Yeah.
Term life is clearly not a security.
Correct. State-regulated insurance only.
Okay, but let's continue the real estate analogy. Cautious Carl gets a massive promotion at work. He's making good money now. He's tired of renting his life insurance and having nothing to show for it.
He wants to build some equity.
He wants to buy a house. He wants a policy that lasts his entire life, no matter how long he lives. And he wants to build up some equity inside the policy. So he upgrades. He buys whole life insurance. Sometimes you'll see it called ordinary life.
Whole life provides permanent coverage. It lasts for Carl's entire life, guaranteed, as long as he pays the premiums. And unlike term, it has a built-in savings component. It builds cash value over time on a tax-deferred basis.
Cash value, equity. This is where the red flags start to wave for exam takers. The moment you say cash value, it sounds like an investment account. So let's run the golden rule test. Who bears the risk of that cash value growing? What happens if the market tanks?
In a whole life policy, the insurance company guarantees the cash value growth at a strict fixed rate.
Oh.
Right. They set the rate, let's say 3%, and they promise Carl that his cash value will grow by that exact amount every single year, guaranteed. Furthermore, his monthly premiums are mathematically fixed and guaranteed never ever to increase for his entire life.
So if the stock market crashes, Carl's cash value still grows at the guaranteed fixed rate. The insurance company takes the hit if their general account investments underperform.
Exactly. The insurance company is absorbing all the risk. Because the insurer bears all the investment risk and strictly guarantees the cash value growth, whole life insurance is not a security.
It's just a more robust, more expensive insurance product with a savings feature.
Not a security. Okay, now enter indecisive Irene again.
She's back.
Irene likes the idea of permanent coverage, and she really likes the idea of building cash value equity. But she looks at Carl's whole life policy and says, it's too rigid.
It's like a 30-year fixed mortgage. I don't want to be locked into paying the exact same premium every single month for the rest of my life.
What if I lose my job and want to pay less next year? What if I want to increase my death benefit when I have kids?
Irene wants flexibility. She wants an adjustable mortgage. So the insurance industry created universal life insurance.
Universal life. How does this solve Irene's indecision? How does it actually work mechanically?
Universal life is permanent coverage, just like whole life. But the key features, the words you need to look for on the exam, are flexible premiums and adjustable death benefits.
So Irene can choose to pay a massive premium 1 year to build up her cash value really fast.
Or she can choose to pay the bare minimum the next year. If she builds up enough cash value equity, she can even use that cash to pay the premiums internally and skip writing a check altogether.
And what about the growth of that cash value? Is it perfectly guaranteed at a flat 3% like Carl's whole life?
This is the nuance where people get confused. The cash value in Universal Life earns an interest rate that is declared and set by the insurance company.
It's not a strict flat guarantee for life like Carl's, because the insurer adjusts the interest rate periodically, maybe annually, based on current market conditions.
If interest rates are high, they might credit her 5%. If they drop, they might credit her 3%. However, and this is the absolute crucial part, the contract always includes a guaranteed minimum interest rate floor, let's say 2%.
Okay, let's put these side by side because this is ripe for exam confusion. Whole life, think rigid, fixed premiums, fixed death benefit, guaranteed fixed cash value growth rate.
Universal life, think flexible, adjustable premiums, adjustable death benefit, fluctuating interest rate set by the insurer, but with a guaranteed minimum floor.
Now here is the exam trap. Because Universal Life has a fluctuating interest rate that changes based on market conditions, students immediately jump to the conclusion that it's a security.
Is it? No. Universal Life is still not a security. Apply the golden rule, always. Who sets the fluctuating interest rate?
The insurance company.
Who guarantees the minimum 2% floor if the economy collapses?
The insurance company.
Irene is not picking stocks. She is not directing the investments. She is not bearing the primary investment risk. Therefore, it is state-regulated insurance only.
Okay, we've covered term, whole, and universal. None of them are securities. We have been playing in the safe, shallow end of the pool.
It is time to dive into the deep end. You hear those casino sirens going off again? Vegas Val is back.
Val wants life insurance to protect her family, but she looks at the guaranteed interest rates of whole and universal life and rolls her eyes. Val demands to pick her own investments. She wants massive market returns on her cash value.
So she buys variable life insurance.
And the moment you see the word variable on this exam, you should hear alarm bells ringing in your head.
Variable life provides permanent coverage, and it requires a fixed level premium, just like whole life. But the cash value, where's the cash value kept? Is it in the general account?
The cash value is absolutely not kept in the insurance company's general account.
Nope.
It is walled off. It's kept in a separate account, and Val gets to take her cash value and invest into. Say it with me.
Sub-accounts. The witness protection mutual funds return. Val gets to pick the aggressive tech stock sub-accounts for her life insurance cash value.
And because she is actively picking the sub-accounts and directing the investments, let's ask the question. Who bears the investment risk?
Val does, 100%.
Val does. Her cash value will fluctuate daily with the performance of those sub-accounts. There is absolutely no guaranteed cash value.
If her tech stocks crash to zero, her cash value literally crashes to zero. Because she bears the investment risk, variable life is a security.
Which means, legally.
It means the heavy hand of federal regulation comes down. It must be registered with the SEC and FINRA. It must be sold with a prospectus outlining the sub-account risks. And the agent selling it must have both a securities license and an insurance license.
Okay, let me pause and ask a critical mechanical question here. This feels like a massive exam trap waiting to happen. Val's sub-accounts crash. Her cash value goes to literal zero. And then she gets hit by a bus. Does her family get nothing? Does the life insurance part just evaporate because her tech investments failed? What's the point of life insurance then?
That is the exact trap. You must memorize this specific distinction for variable life. Variable life has no guaranteed cash value, but it does have a guaranteed minimum death benefit.
Let's unpack that. How can that exist?
When Val bought the policy, let's say she bought a $500,000 face amount. That $500,000 is the guaranteed minimum death benefit. As long as she pays her fixed premium every month, that death benefit is locked in.
If her sub-accounts perform amazingly well, her cash value skyrockets, and her death benefit might actually dynamically increase above $500,000 to maybe $600,000.
But if her sub-accounts crash and burn, her cash value might drop to zero, but the death benefit will never, ever drop below that guaranteed $500,000 minimum.
The insurance company absorbs the mortality risk of paying out the $500,000, but Val absorbs the investment risk on the cash value accumulation.
Fascinating. So the cash value can zero out, but the death benefit has a permanent floor as long as premiums are paid. Okay, we have one final monster to slay in the life insurance arena. Imagine a terrifying fusion dance between Indecisive Irene and Vegas Val.
Oh boy, the ultimate hybrid.
Irene's desire for ultimate premium flexibility combined with Val's desire for extreme investment risk. The result is a Frankenstein product called Variable Universal Life, VUL.
It is exactly what it sounds like. It takes the flexible premiums and adjustable death benefit mechanics from Universal Life, and it slams them together with the sub-account investment options of Variable Life.
So you can literally skip your premium payments if you want, dynamically change your death benefit when you have a kid, and day trade your cash value in aggressive sub-accounts all at the exact same time.
Yes. It is the absolute most flexible life insurance product on the market. But with that extreme flexibility comes the greatest complexity, the highest fees, and a greatest risk.
Let's run the golden rule one last time. Does VUL have sub-accounts? Yes. Who picks them? The policyholder. Who bears the risk if the market crashes? The policyholder. Is it a security?
Yes. Absolutely a security. Prospectus required. Dual licenses required.
Yes.
SEC and FINRA regulated.
Which brings us to the final stretch. The rapid-fire recap and the ultimate cheat code. If your brain is swimming right now with all these different products, I am going to throw you a life raft. It is the variable rule.
If you remember nothing else from the last hour, remember this. This is the closest thing to a literal cheat code you will ever get on the Series 66.
Look at the name of the product in the exam question. Just look at the words on the screen. Does the name of the product contain the word variable? If the answer is yes, it is a security. If the answer is no, it is not a security. Let's test the logic.
Variable annuity.
Yes, has the word variable. It's a security.
Variable life.
Yes, has variable security.
Variable universal life.
Yes, has variable security.
Equity indexed annuity.
Does it say variable? No. Even though it tracks the market, no variable means not a security.
Whole life.
No variable, not a security.
It really is that simple.
That's it.
The word variable instantly tells you that the product utilizes sub-accounts. Sub-accounts tell you that the owner bears the investment risk. The owner-bearing risk tells you it's a security requiring a prospectus. It is a direct, unbreakable, logical chain.
Okay, time for a rapid-fire quiz for you, the listener. I'm going to throw three specific scenarios at you. I will leave a beat for you to answer in your head, and then we will give the correct response. Ready? Let's go. Question one. You are annuitizing your contract. Which payout option gives you the mathematically biggest monthly check? Life only, or joint and survivor?
Give me a second.
Life only. Because the insurance company keeps everything when you die, they are taking on the least actuarial risk, so they pay you the most per month. Joint and survivor pays the least.
Question two. I am 50 years old. I take $20,000 out of my variable annuity. My account is mostly earnings. What is the specific tax hit?
Think about it.
It is taxed as LIFO, ordinary income tax, PLAUS, a 10% IRS early withdrawal penalty because you are under 59 and a half. The double hit.
Question three. What specific fee is charged to cover the insurer's risk of guaranteeing lifetime income payments? And what specific product is it completely unique to?
Got it.
The mortality and expense risk charge, the M&E fee, and it is entirely unique to variable annuities.
Boom. If you nail those, you are in incredible shape for this unit.
If we pull back and look at the bigger picture here, stepping away from the exam for a second, all of these products, from the simplest term life to the incredibly complex variable universal life at their core, they're just human attempts to engineer away the terror of the unknown.
We are terrified of outliving our money in retirement, so we invent annuities. We are terrified of dying too soon and leaving our families destitute, so we invent life insurance.
It's incredible when you think about it. Wall Street and the insurance companies essentially sat down and built a massive dial. You want to turn that dial all the way to absolute safety. You get Cautious Carl's 4% fixed annuity, but you sacrifice wealth generation.
You want to turn the dial all the way to aggressive growth. You get Vegas Val's variable products, but you sacrifice your safety net.
And the SEC simply stands right in the middle of that dial, drawing a line in the sand saying, the moment you cross this line and take the financial risk yourself, we step in to regulate it.
And before we go, I want to leave you with a thought to mull over. We've talked extensively about this line between insurance and securities being drawn strictly by who bears the risk, but think about where financial technology is heading.
Oh, with AI and everything.
Right. With artificial intelligence now able to instantly adjust personal risk algorithms by the millisecond, analyzing market data faster than humanly possible. How long until that line disappears completely? What happens when a product adjusts your risk-bearing status in real time, minute by minute, bouncing back and forth across that SEC line?
That is a wild thought. A constantly shifting security to insurance chameleon product.
The regulatory framework we just spent an hour discussing might have to be entirely rewritten in the next decade.
I don't even want to know what the Series 66 is going to look like when that happens. But for now, as you head into your exam this month, remember the blurry diagnostic landscape we started with.
It's not so murky anymore.
You have the compass. You are armed with the golden rule. Just stop, take a breath, and ask yourself, who is taking the hit if the market falls apart? Trust the mechanics, trust the variable cheat code, and go crush those 17 questions.